With us on the Bloggers Roundtable today, we've got Colonel Jeff Haynes, who is the, actually, I guess I should introduce you as the former commanding officer of Regional Corps Advisory Command Central, and the 201st Corps Afghan National Army from Afghanistan, just recently left. And we didn't get a chance to catch up with you before you left country, so let's take the opportunity to do that now. And you've got some things you want to talk about, so Colonel Haynes, the floor is yours.
Okay, everybody, thanks for having me on tonight. Hopefully everyone was able to read the one-pager I sent out as far as the topics for tonight. We'd like to describe the RCAC very briefly for those that don't understand. It is about a 750-man or service member organization from five NATO countries and basically does the mentoring for all of 201st Corps, which is basically RC East. And that is Kabul Province, Wardak, Logar, Kapisa, Parwan, Panjshir, Nangarhar, Kunar, Nuristan, and Logman. And I was in command of that organization, and I had a staff of about 25 Marines plus several National Guard and Navy and Army personnel. In addition to commanding the organization that did all the mentoring, we mentored the Corps staff, and my counterpart was the 201st Corps commanding general. Coming out of this tour, I have several observations. First, I think we seem to be fixated as a country on getting more U.S. troops into Afghanistan, which is certainly a good thing, but I think another question that needs to be asked is what is the ANA doing for us for the fight? How well are we in the ANA or leveraging the strengths and mitigating the weaknesses of the ANA? And are we relying too much on U.S. and coalition forces to do the heavy lifting in the coin fight? I do not think we're doing enough with the ANA. We're demanding enough out of the Afghan National Army considering the investment we've put into them. In some cases, we hold them back. In other cases, I think we need to be kicking them in the tail and getting them moving. One thing I wanted to kind of throw out on the table next, and more importantly, this being a counterinsurgency fight, you know, you have several lines of operation, security, governance, information, economic development, and I think we lack a holistic vision. And we don't synergize our resources, being money from USAID or activities of different NGOs or security forces, both on the Afghan and coalition side. I don't believe we synergize those resources and those activities and efforts well enough to make a lasting, enduring difference in the areas outside of Kabul, 99% of the country. Sometimes I think we're a little bit too focused on the urban areas, but this is a rural counterinsurgency. Insurgency, it derives its strength from a number of places, but some of that strength comes from the population, the hinterlands, and we need to synergize these resources, talking about developmental resources or coin enablers, as I like to call them, to permanently isolate the population or the insurgent from the population. And further, I have nine observations I list in the Word document that hopefully all of you you all saw before coming on tonight, or I guess this morning for you guys. And I won't read all of those, but those are other things that we can talk about throughout our conversation here. So basically, I think in a nutshell, we need to be a little bit more thoughtful and the way we're fighting this war and focus more on the population, less on the enemy. We need to synergize resources for a permanent transformation of the environment to permanently isolate the insurgent from the population. And at the end of the day, if we could transform chosen valleys, and we in the 201st Corps, we chose the Gai Valley and Kapisa Province to start this transformation process. If we could transform strategically our well-picked valleys, I think we could start to transform the environment and turn this fight around. That's all I have for an opening statement.
All right, sir. Well, thank you very much. So, Andrew, you were first online. Why don't you get us started?
Great. Colonel Andrew Lubin from U.S. Naval Institute Magazine's Proceedings. Thanks for joining us again. Sir, yesterday there was in the Wall Street Journal, big article, and to summarize it, it sounds like they want the coalition force to pull back around Kabul and do a hedgehog. That can't be an effective long-term strategy. But your Kapisa province and Dagob strategy, you'd be a blocking force. Why aren't people putting more effort into operations such as what you're doing? What do you hear back from the General Cones, McKiernans, and the upper-level officers on this?
Well, being that article just came out, I'm out of country. I'm back in Okinawa now. Certainly haven't heard much from them. But I do not believe at all that we should bring in forces to Kabul. I think that's a mistake. It's obviously a decision well above my pay grade. But that's one thing the Northern Alliance and other forces throughout Afghanistan history has caused whatever government was in power to do is to pull forces into Kabul, and then you leave the rural hinterlands open to the insurgents. And this being a rural insurgency, you need to be out in the countryside, again, isolating the population from the insurgent and protecting that population, keeping the insurgent from getting strength and support from the population. So bringing in forces to Kabul, I do not think that is a good idea at all. Now, approaches to Kabul, like what we're doing in Dagob province, that route, they call it MSR Vermont, runs north-south through Dagob and Kapisa province, Dagob district. By transforming that valley, you're severing one of the major routes that runs east and west, from east to west, from Pakistan to Kabul. You're severing that route by developing the Dagob Valley. And I think that provides you protection for Kabul by fighting them, not necessarily deep would be inside of Pakistan on the Pak border, but fighting them more or less middle, halfway between the border, and in this case the Kunar province area, and in Kabul halfway would, you could call it Dagob about halfway. So fight them in the middle and instead of fighting them in the city itself.
Well, then, guys, can I follow up on this because only a few of us? Then can you talk to us about Golden Spike because that was just coming on right before I left. That would be a relative success story about keeping them out of Kabul and fighting them on, out 50 miles out.
Yeah, Golden Spike was an operation. And when I talk about Kapisa and Golden Spike and Dagob, I'm talking about ANA, an ANA campaign that was conceived, planned, and executed by the ANA without any assistance other than ETTs and the ARCAC and my staff. And the execution of Golden Spike was the culmination of the first major phase of the Naglo campaign, not to give you too many place names, but essentially Golden Spike consisted of a Kandak, about a 650-man battalion-sized force moving from central Kapisa or northern Dagob and moving south and linking up with another Kandak that came from the south, and basically we connected the dots between the Naglo Reservoir and the northern portion of the Dagob district and conducted a link-up operation and part of this operation involved a lot of CMO activities. We did HA drops. We did med caps. Shuras with the population. The ANA were out. The ANA general officers and religious officer and Mullah were out talking with the population and talking about further developmental opportunities that are on the horizon for Dagob. And by doing so, you're demonstrating the population that the Afghan government does care about them and are willing to, the government is willing to invest in those people. And in turn, those people are now turning in IEDs and telling us where the IEDs are. They're calling the brigade commander and Kandak commander on cell phones and telling them where insurgents are located. So it really is. Golden Spike was really a true success story. And the neat thing is that none of the coalition forces would go down in southern Dagob because it was supposedly ruled by the bad guys. And it was supposedly too dangerous. So the ANA said, no, not going to happen on my watch. And 201st Corps went in there and not only went in there, but they cleared the entire route and conducted HA ops, and they continue to conduct HA and combat ops in that strategic valley.
Great, thank you.
All right, Chuck.
Good evening, Colonel. We recently talked with one of your counterparts with 207 Corps, I believe it was.
205.
Okay. And one of the kind of disturbing things that, that he talked about was that there was an entire province in his area of operation that had no Afghan army presence. And when I tried to question him about whether there were enough Afghan troops, and I don't think he, that I communicated very well, 201 Corps, is it fully manned? Are there enough Afghan troops to begin to take and hold the ground, or do they need more troops?
Well, 201st is fully manned as a corps, for a core table of organization, but is a core big enough to control the battle space that they've been tasked to by the Minister of Defense? Absolutely not, especially given the fact that the police are not coming online as fast as we would like. Once the ANA clears an area and starts doing some of these more soft approaches with HA and CMO, we need to be able to backfill areas that the Army has cleared with police. And we just can't do that right now. And we were screaming for police and Tagab as the ANA would go through there and make things right. The ANA does not have enough depth to just sit there and hold ground for an extended period of time. That's the ground that's already been cleared of the enemy. We needed to backfill that with police. So, number one, my point is the core itself, a core is not big enough to manage the battle space that it's currently charged with. And number two, if we had police to backfill in some of the areas where the Corps is operating now, that would help mitigate the lack of force out there. Now, certainly General Cohn and the leaders in Afghanistan recognize this, and they're working through an accelerated program to grow the Afghan army. I believe it's 134,000 is their target. And that's great news as long as we do it right. My concern is that we do not build too many more headquarters, that we just make larger companies and larger CANDACs, because there's a leadership shortage of good officers in the ANA. There's a shortage of competent, non-corrupt, dedicated officers in the ANA. Now, there's a lot of great officers. There's just not enough of them to start building more CANDACs and more brigades. So as part of this expansion plan, the Afghan Army is going to have to figure out how to select and develop leaders for these CANDACs, companies, and brigades.
All right. And a quick follow-up. Your counterpart with 205 talked about how they were working on independent logistics and independent air support. How is 201 doing with those type of necessary but kind of advanced military operations?
Yeah, let me tell you, late July or early August, we did the what we were told was the first ANA heliborne assault in ANA helicopters. Now, certainly we've had 201st Corps and U.S. Army 47th and Blackhawks, but we put ANA soldiers in Mi-17s right out of Policharkey, 201st Corps. We used 3rd Brigade troops and put them up in the Jowzak area in southern Parwan, and that is significant because it was summer, so that the temperatures were in the 90s, and the altitudes were in excess of 8,000 feet, and if you know anything about aviation, you know that's quite a strain.
That's real thin air.
Helicopter, and has a lot to do with density altitude and the performance of the aircraft, and they've done very well when given the opportunity to work with the Afghan airframes. And, you know, of course, my 2nd Brigade guys out there with 173rd during the summer did a lot of air assault ops, but I don't necessarily count those because those are heavily mentored and with U.S. Army airframes. But to answer your question, ANA has come a long way in using their own helicopters. We just couldn't get enough rotor time in those ANA helicopters. I actually personally flew an ANA air quite a bit in those Mi-17s. The ones that have been built by the Czech Republic are very reliable, a great airframe for that environment. You also talked about logistics. I'll tell you, in extreme eastern Kabul province, Sarobi district, and I wish we had a way of having a map up that we could all see, but if you know where Sarobi is, and just on the northern side of Sarobi is Naglo Reservoir, and then you get to Katisa province. 3rd Brigade, very, very well-led brigade by General Zamorai, conducted, like we talked about, Golden Spike, and what was significant about that was the logistical demands that were put on the ANA. Not only did we have 113s out there, mechanized vehicles, we had all the HA and CMO activities we were conducting that are very intensive on the logistics side, transportation, fuel, ground transportation and lift and that type of thing. And they did very, very well conducting those operations. Also, 1st Brigade and Wardak and Logar have built a lot of their own positions with their own logistics and engineers, heavy equipment, and the 1st Brigade along Highway 1 in Wardak Province. They were doing that throughout the summer. So progress is being made. I'll also tell you that in Tagaw Province, the ANA is building their own FOBs, and that's bullet number 8 about the expeditionary FOB concept. Instead of waiting on the standard process that takes about a year to build a camp, these guys in the ANA figured out how we could break the code and do it in about a couple months, as long as we could get the contracts lined up for things like gravel and HESCOs. But out in Tagab, we ordered them some containers, shipping containers, and made those into living quarters. They made them into living quarters. They moved them out there. They built their own berms with their own heavy equipment. They have their own OPs. They've built out of just rocks and sandbags and a lot of dozer work, and they're getting after it on their own. Now, some of that's engineering, but, of course, the logistics tail to support the engineering effort is pretty significant. So things were going well when I left, and the guys just sent me a few pictures a couple of days ago, and they're out there at the 4-2 Northing in that new 5 in Tagab.
Thank you.
All right, Troy.
All right, so good, sounds good. Welcome back, sir. It's good to talk to you again, and glad you got back to your home station. You're safe. This is Troy Stewart from BlueHammer.com. First question, corruption is a root problem to the ANA's ability to progress. You've already mentioned it a few times, and we've known it's been going on forever. In what ways can we, as a coalition force, eliminate this significant piece of their culture that's ingrained in their culture? Or what ways have you tried that were successful?
Well, that's a tough one. I personally talked to General Wardak, not Minister Wardak, but General Wardak at 201st Corps, and he was very concerned about corruption. He led by example in eliminating corruption whenever he was alerted to it and could prove it. I had what I called red lines, anything dealing with ammo, weapons, the like, or explosives. Or we were going to go to all stop and investigate that. And in some cases, in one case, in fact, early on, I had to threaten to pull an ETT off of a Kandak because the corruption was just absolutely beyond comprehension. And it would put my guys in danger. And the ANA did the right thing, and they investigated the corruption. They found the certain soldiers to be guilty, and they relieved a Kandak commander. And it was a great news story, not because we had to fire somebody, but because they replaced a substandard commander with a very, very good commander, and that's 2-2 Kandak up in extreme northern Kunar and Nuristan. And that Kandak is doing great things right now, still. But there is a lot of corruption. We have other places due to ethnic ties that, quite frankly, some folks need to go away, and they weren't made to go away because they were that well connected. And it is a problem. Absolutely, it is by no means everywhere. It's not in every unit, but in limited cases, it's very bad, and it needs to be dealt with. And I do not know how to deal with it at the higher levels. I know some of the leadership at 201 First Corps went up to MOD and tried to get some things resolved, and they couldn't due to a variety of reasons. But what worked for us, though, at the lower levels was when we knew of corruption, we identified it without emotion, just the facts, and we urged the Afghans to take it on as an Afghan problem and solve it themselves, and 90% of the time, and especially when they were allowed to, they did.
Okay. Did your corps commander delegate the ability for CANDAC commanders or brigade commanders to fire or relieve ANA commanders at any level?
That was, you know, on paper, supposedly they're allowed to relieve people, but it was very, very difficult for the corps commander to relieve a CANDAC commander, and impossible for a corps commander, at least during my time and with the 201st, for a corps commander to relieve a commander senior to a CANDAC commander.
All right. It hasn't changed much then. Okay, thank you, sir.
All right, and Greg.
Colonel, I was wondering, could you, since we're on the topic of corruption here, I'd just be curious. There are a couple of kinds of corruption, I guess. There's, you know, corruption out of necessity, just to survive, and then there's, a different kind. I think you referenced the ethnic. Could you just explain a little bit more when you speak corruption? You're talking about soldiers selling weapons, ammunition, just to get enough food. Or get enough money so they can get food to their families, or are you talking higher levels of corruption?
Oh, I don't know of any cases where anybody sold a weapon so they could feed their family. The soldiers are, you know, they're paid better than they used to be, and a lot of fuel seems to disappear. Some of the trucks only get 1 to 2 miles a gallon, if you know what I mean. And when we find an Afghan truck that only gets that kind of gas mileage, we take it and we put it in maintenance, and they get the message. I don't believe it's out of necessity. I believe it's out of short-sightedness and plain criminal activity, quite frankly.
But that's something that you can only address at the highest of levels, it sounds like. Huh?
Yeah, I mean, there's low-end stuff going on, guys stealing from one another, but that happens in a lot of organizations. That's nothing to get too wound up about. That's a leadership issue they can deal with at the lower levels, but when massive amounts of fuel are disappearing and money that was designated for food purchases out in the eastern zone disappears, well, we've got some problems, and we've been addressing that.
In the recent news reports that someone referenced earlier, was that part of this incoming brigade is going to be going to Wardak and Logar provinces because of the deteriorating security situation there, and since you've got some on-the-ground experience, could you speak about what's happened over the past year or so? How bad are things getting in that area?
Well, the ANA was directed presidential priority to provide security to Highway 1. We all know how important that is. And the 1st Brigade did a fine job of getting out there with the few forces they had, and they were the CANDAC, which really hurt them. With the few forces they had on the route on Highway 1 and the route that runs north-south through Logar Province, and put out positions and build their own fighting positions with their engineering capacity they have. And they made a difference. They cut back on a lot of the IEDs we were seeing in the middle of the summer. A lot of the attacks were reduced significantly. I can't give you any percentages off the top of my head, but significantly reduced later into the fall. So the road got a little bit safer, got somewhat safer. But and the reports I'm reading is, you know, in some places the Taliban are, if you believe what you read in the open press, they own the battle space out there in some cases, and that's certainly unacceptable. And our senior leaders recognize that, and I guess that's why they're putting the additional troops into Wardak and Logar. I mean, that's going to be a tough place. There's some valleys out there, particularly a valley that connects Highway 1 and over to Logar Province. That's going to be a tough fight in there. But I think it certainly is the right thing to do to get more capable U.S. forces in there, and Wardak and Logar, and clean things up, and then hopefully by then we'll have more of the A&A deployed out there, and they can assume a larger role in the fight. And part of it, quite frankly, is, again, getting those police up. If we could get the police protecting the highway and get Kandaks off the highway and out into the hinterlands where the Taliban are held up and get in there and clear out some of those feeder valleys, I think we'd be that much better off for it. Get the Army doing Army things and the police doing police things.
Who's doing the ANP training mission? Is that ISAF or is the U.S. taking that over?
The U.S. is doing that through the DMTs.
Thank you.
All right. Got a few minutes left here. Anybody, any follow-up questions?
Yeah, I got one. Colonel Andrew, again, can you talk to us about the economics of what's happening in the Tagab Valley, small business programs and the microloans? Have the PRTs done anything, or is this coming from your ETTs and the ANAs?
Well, the PRT for that area is located up at Bagram, and they just geographically it's easier for them to get to northern Kapisa, and the location of the Corps headquarters and the RCAC located at Policharki, it's certainly easier for us to, now that we've the route to enter from the south and to get into the GAB. And what we've done is we've started an A&A PRT in 201st Corps to work some of these economic and development projects. And it's gone well. We've started with a couple pilot programs, one being we've introduced Saffron. We've got funding, and right before we left in October, the contractor working with the population there, and I believe in the Kamshin K area in southern Tagab, planted only about 6,000 square meters of saffron, but that's a labor-intensive crop that can be fairly profitable about after the second season. We've SERP'd a project that some projects out there for wells. We've also contracted and had NGOs teach pomegranate packaging to the population and pruning techniques that will increase the yield of pomegranates. And with all the traffic we have out there, the ANA, working on the road, some small businesses in the form of this, stands with selling snacks and drinks and that kind of thing, they've popped up in the area, so that's putting a little bit of money into the economy, and we encourage the Afghans and the Marines to purchase things from these small stands just to engage the population every chance we get. We're very willing and open when it comes to dealing with the population. We get out, the ETTs and the ANA are out with the population, talking to them. Kind of a grassroots approach to transforming that battle space down there and taking it away from the Taliban, the HIG, and the type of folks that run around in the lower Tagab. But we certainly want to listen to the population, see what their needs are without turning it into a welfare state. We're very, very aware if we just start giving them stuff, they're just going to want more and more and more and not appreciate it. So whenever we provide something for them, we make them become part of the solution. If they want an irrigation well, we may provide the well, but they're going to dig the ditches, that type of approach.
Okay, great, thanks.
Okay.
And it's working well.
All right, sir.
All right.
Okay, anything else?
I'd like to ask quick follow-up. What is it going to take to, there's the military set a goal of increasing the size of the ANA, almost doubling the size of the ANA. What's it going to take to make that happen, to turn that into the competent force that we'd hope it to become?
Well, leadership. And leadership to me, and what I've seen in the COIN environment, in this environment when you have small units operating somewhat independently, if you can select good leaders, that's most of the challenge right there. Equipment, yeah, we can give them AK-47s, you can give them an M4. Don't really care. The leadership's got to come first. Units with the good leaders, they seem to solve their logistical problems. They seem to have less corruption. They seem to make mission. So, it's going to be more complicated than that. If you're a C-stick, a force generation guy, I mean, you're going to have a hard life working through this problem because it is very complex. It does involve a lot of money, and the consolidating fielding concept seems to be a win in providing somewhat trained and equipped CANDAC coming out of KMTC. They have a stop at the Consolidated Fielding Center where they're equipped and further trained, and they get out to their cores, and they're that much more capable and ready to go. But it's going to take a lot of organization, a lot of timing and phasing of gear and equipment. But at the end of the day, if you don't have good leadership, it really doesn't matter. And certainly you're going to need good, competent, capable ETTs that are very, very aggressive and ready to get out, get after it, get off the FOB, not worried about getting shot at. You have to get after it, and that's what we've done in 201st Corps. And it hasn't been free. I mean, we've taken some casualties and lost some great Americans, but that's what it's going to take to win this fight and grow this Army as quick as we want to grow it. But the other thing is, I mean, we can have a super capable Army and great leadership, but if we don't understand COIN and we don't connect PRT-like capabilities, the Provincial Reconstruction Team-like capabilities, to the A&A, I don't think we're going to be successful. We're not going to be successful very quickly. We've got to understand that COIN involves more than just chasing bad guys. And sometimes I think our orientation is too much on the enemy and not on the population. We've got to win the population. We've got to give the population something, or not give, but help the population achieve something worth their fighting for. They need to be part of the solution. And if they have a level of prosperity and safety and rule of law, et cetera, not necessarily governed from Kabul, that may just be a bridge too far for a while, but if they have a standard of living and a way of life that they're ready to fight for, then I think we've won. But we're only going to achieve that by having them engaged and helping with the development, helping with the job creation, being part of the solution, just not on the sidelines as U.S. and coalition and Afghan forces run up and down these valleys.
All right. I think we had one more.
Yeah, this is Troy. If I could ask one more.
Okay, go ahead.
Sir, it's kind of tailspins or tails on to the last question. Is developing and enforcing an Afghan uniform code of military justice, in your opinion, is it crucial for the Afghan Army to become a disciplined fighting force?
They need some kind of disciplinary process. If it's UCMJ, you know, they do need some type of UCMJ, I think. Does it have to be just like ours? No. It has to be something that works within their culture, but there does have to be some sense of accountability in the Afghan Army. And right now, consequences for behavior, good or bad, just doesn't seem to be there. It doesn't seem to be as timely or as dramatic, I guess, as it needs to be.
Which leads to corruption because there's no accountability and no enforcement, and then leads to soldiers not really caring about their country, just there for a paycheck.
Left unchecked, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
All right, sir. Well, we're about out of time here. Any closing thoughts, Colonel?
Yeah, again, I just want to emphasize the Afghan National Army needs the tools to win in the COIN fight, and that's setting conditions for economic development. And the Afghan Army, National Army, also needs to be competent enough and given the opportunity to own the battle space. When they own battle space, they own the problem, they do very, very well. If we over-partner and we do everything with the U.S. Army or other forces, the Afghan Army is not going to develop. They're going to be more prone to sit on the sidelines and watch the coalition forces do it, and we're going to be there for a very long time with a whole lot of Americans.
All right, sir. Thank you very much for joining us today, and we do appreciate it. And, well, hopefully we can speak again, perhaps on your new mission.
Okay.